Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. The Moth Podcast is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Catherine Burns, Artistic Director of The Moth, and I'll be your host this time. The Moth is true stories told live without notes. We have three stories this hour. A flight attendant tells us why the skies are sometimes not so friendly. A little boy's father tries to smuggle him out of South Vietnam. And a Texas preacher learns something in the pool hall that he'd never dreamt of in the seminary. Our first story is from Faye Lane. I don't know about you, but whenever I'm on a plane, I'm always curious about the flight attendants. I know they have to act nice to everyone, but what are they really thinking? Are they judging me for ordering that whiskey? Well, Faye Lane had been telling stories for us for a number of years before it came out that she is an honest-to-God flight attendant, and we bugged her and bugged her to tell us what that's really like. We got her to tell her story in Portland, Oregon. We usually try to keep our shows intimate, but there were over 3,000 people in the audience for this one. Here's Faye Lane live at the Moth.
Hello. Oh, thank you so much. What I always wanted as a little bitty girl was to tell stories on the stage because I wanted to be connected to something bigger than myself, and I wanted to be connected to other people. And I believe that a performer takes a group of individuals and through a shared emotional experience, turns it into a collective. So since I was this big, I've wanted to do this. I've wanted to be a performer. / stewardess. I grew up in my mama's beauty shop in Texas. It was this old A-frame house with big mirrors and swivel chairs in the front room and shampoo bowls in the old back bedroom. And my mama had this long line of hood dryers on one wall, and I would wait until all the ladies were held captive under the dryers, and I would give these mandatory concerts. That was my very first stage. This is so much better. When I wasn't telling stories and doing shows for the ladies, I would play stewardess, and I would push this little manicure cart around the beauty shop. Miss Helen, Miss Melba, would y'all like a magazine? Would y'all like a cocktail? And the ladies would say, baby, you just give great customer service. I was all about customer service. And sometimes I'd sit on the porch playing with my Barbie friendship airplane. And sometimes, even in the summer, I would wear this long silk scarf tied on the side. And it's hot in Texas in the summer. But I loved playing stewardess. Well, about 10 years ago, I was living in New York City, working as a performer, telling stories and singing songs on the stage, which, as you can probably imagine, pays about jack shit. No job security, no benefits. I really needed a job. And I very randomly met this lovely girl with a long silk scarf tied on the side who said 9 words that changed my life forever. She said, "Have you ever thought about being a flight attendant?" I had! 3 weeks later, I was in Miami training, and training was amazing and so exciting because the very first day, the founder of the airline, which was brand new, it was this new airline, they had, I think, 7 airplanes, a handful of destinations, and a lot of great buzz. They had buzz around the fact that there was live TV at every seat. They had designer uniforms. But most of the buzz was around the fact that they had amazing customer service. Perfect. I was all about customer service back at the beauty shop. So when the founder of the airline, the founder and the CEO, came into our training class and gave this amazing, uplifting speech, I knew I was in the right place and the right job. He said, "Every one of you is here for a reason. And that reason is your ability to smile and be kind." He said, "We can teach you how to evacuate an airplane. We can teach you how to handle a medical emergency. We can teach you how to serve, but we cannot teach you to smile and be kind. Your mother did that. Please thank her for me." So beautiful. He said he saw this not as an airline, not as a corporation, but as a humanitarian experiment. Thank you. I know. He said his goal was to bring humanity back to air travel. And I was right on board with this vision. I was so caught up in it. And when I graduated, they made me president of my class. And they even gave me this award, the special certificate called the Spirit Award. And I couldn't wait to get out there on the line and to surprise people with kindness. And in the process of moving people from point A to point B, to really actually move people. And then I graduated. And then I started the job. Maybe you see where this is going. I had this epiphany. This job is hard. And people are horrible. Really horrible. First of all, the job was exhausting, physically exhausting. In the beginning, I was on reserve, which means that I was on call and I had to be within 2 hours of Kennedy Airport at all times. So I was either running to get to the airport or waiting for the phone call to run to get to the airport, constantly just totally on edge and exhausted. And then getting to the airport, the actual commute was extremely hard. I had to take the subway to the bus, to the shuttle, to the terminal. Even before I got on the plane, I was exhausted. And then when I did get on the plane, there was a whole world of hurt. My feet hurt from, there's this thing that happens where you get bruises on the bottom of your feet from turbulence. Yeah, and it was horrible. And new flight attendants are sick a lot because it's kind of like a kindergarten teacher. You're exposed to a lot of germs, mainly because I'm taking garbage from everyone, you know, and saying thank you for it. Thank you. Thank you for your garbage. Thank you. In fact, they made us stop calling it trash. We have to call it service items. Because some of the really bitter ones would say, "Sir, you're trash." "Ma'am, your whole family's trash." But I understand why they were jaded, because I was kind of getting jaded. I got fairly jaded fairly quickly, too, because I just couldn't believe how horrible people could be. It's really hard when someone is smiling in your face and handing you a cup of coffee and a cookie, here you go. It's hard to be mean, but people do. People are mean, even when you're smiling in their face, because a lot of times they don't see you, they just see a uniform. And traveling is hard, it's stressful, and people were just ugly. But but I tried really hard to keep that vision and to smile and to be kind, even in the face of meanness. And I had a really, I think I hit kind of a bottom one day when I had a passenger who had a heart attack on my flight. And he was lying in the aisle, and we had opened his shirt, and we had the pads of the defibrillator on him, and I was holding an oxygen bottle. And this woman in the row sitting next to me kept tugging on my blouse. "Excuse me, excuse me." I was like, "Just a minute, please. You know, we're trying to save this guy's life." She kept tugging, tugging. I said, "Just a minute, just a minute." And then I thought, wait a minute, maybe she has an emergency. You know, or maybe she knows something. So I said, "What is it?" And she held up her coffee cup. And she said, "This coffee is cold." And I learned that people can be cold. And also, there's something that happens to your psychology when you fly a lot, because you see the world from above. And I saw a lot of really horrible things from the air, like devastating California forest fires, New Orleans underwater, and most upsetting for me, Lower Manhattan still smoldering for weeks and weeks. And in late September of 2001, I was working a flight, and a passenger came on with a garbage bag, which is kind of a flight attendant pet peeve, because really, sir, a garbage bag? 14th Street, $9.99, get a rollerboard, you know? But you see that, sometimes people just throw things in a garbage bag and bring it on. So he goes to row two, which is where he was seated, and he opened the overhead bin, put the garbage bag in, and then actually my second thought was, what's in that garbage bag? Because in late September of 01, we were all still a little edgy and paranoid, and so I was kind of keeping my eye on him and the bag. But he put it in the overhead bin and closed the bin and stood there with his hand on it, guarding it, which is another flight attendant pet peeve. The overhead bins are shared space, okay? And if you hog up all the space, somebody's bag is gonna get checked. And by the way, if you're in row 12, please don't leave your bag in row 1. It's not nice. You're taking somebody's space. So my instinct was to go to this man and say, "Sir, please sit down." But I thought, just let it go. Just let it go. Just smile and be kind. And if we need the space, I'll deal with it later. So I didn't say anything. I also didn't say anything when he got up while the seatbelt sign was on and came and stood waiting for the bathroom. If the seatbelt sign is on, it's because the captain knows something we don't know. You know, and it might not feel bumpy, but he's probably heard from an airplane further along the road or the sky that there's turbulence ahead. So I have a friend who broke his ankle on the ceiling on a smooth flight. So that's another flight attendant pet peeve. He stood there waiting for the bathroom, and I said, "Sir, the seatbelt sign is on." He said, I know, but I really need to go." I thought, let it go. Just let it go. I just wanted to read my book. I was sitting on the jump seat reading. I just wanted to read my book, but it was kind of awkward because he was standing there and I felt like I should say something. So I said, "Are you traveling for business or pleasure?" And he said, "Neither." He said, I live in California, but I came to New York because my son was a first responder at Ground Zero. And he died there. He said, I came to pick up his uniform, which is all I have of him. And it's in a bag in the overhead bin. And I remembered why I was there and why I was hired and why I wanted that job. Because I remembered that everybody has a story, and I don't know what that story is. And people fly for a reason, you know? Maybe they're going to a funeral or to see someone who's sick, or maybe something joyful like a wedding, you know? Or I don't know what their story is, but for that little piece of time, I'm a part of it. And I have an impact on their experience. And my job as a performer, and what I love about performing, is taking a group of individuals and through a shared emotional experience, turning it into a collective. But my job as a flight attendant is to take a collective and to turn it back into a group of individuals. You know, because flight attendants talk about crowds sometimes, like, avoid the Fort Lauderdale crowd, they're horrible. Avoid the Long Beach crowd, they're horrible. But every crowd is a group of individuals, and every individual has a story. And yeah, I saw a lot of horrible things from the air, but I've also seen a lot of amazing, beautiful things from the air, like the Grand Canyon, the Northern Lights, fireworks from above. And now, when I go through the cabin with my garbage bag and saying thank you and smiling, I mean it, because I'm making a gratitude list in my head. And every time I say thank you, I think of something I'm grateful for. Thank you for my job. Thank you for these comfy shoes. Thank you for my life. Because my job enables me to be part of something bigger than me and to be connected to other people like this. So thank you.
That was Faye Lane. Faye lives in the Chelsea Hotel in New York City. To find out what she's up to now, go to themoth.org. In a moment, we'll have a story about a young man risking his life to get his family out of South Vietnam.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Support for The Moth comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so that you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything. CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/moth. That's odoo.com/moth.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Catherine Burns. Next, we have a story from emergency room physician Fa Lei. The theme of the night was Moved, Stories of Safe Passage. We met Fa when he called The Moth's pitch line, and I'll tell you more about that after the story. Here's Fa live at The Moth.
So I was 7 years old. I was living in Vietnam at the time in the countryside. I lived with my mom, my brother, my grandmother, and my aunt and uncle. On this particular day, I'd just come home from school, and I was playing in the front yard with my brother and my aunt. Suddenly, a man appeared in the front yard. He walked straight up to me, bent down to my level, and said, "Are you Ghe?" Ghe means parrot in Vietnamese. And apparently when I was growing up, I learned to speak very early, and I echoed what everyone else said around me. So they called me Ghe. And I said to him, "Yes, I'm Ghe." And looking at him, I thought he looked a lot like my seventh uncle, my dad's brother that I visited recently in Saigon. And I said, "You must be my seventh uncle." And he just smiled, kissed me on the cheek, and yes, said, "Yes, I am your seventh uncle." He then hugged me for a really long time. After that, he asked me to take him to where my mom worked. So we took a short walk and arrived at a tailoring shop where she held a job at the time. I said, "Mom, seventh uncle is here." She looked up, immediately threw down what she was holding, ran out and jumped on him, and proceeded to kiss him and hug him passionately. And I was so confused. So what's going on? When she was able to calm herself down, she walked over to me, got down to my level, and said, "Ghe, this is not your seventh uncle. This is your father." My first childhood memories were of me living with my mom and my brother. But every time I asked about my father, I was told that he died in the war against the communists in Vietnam. My father attended the Naval Academy of the Republic of South Vietnam. He served many years and achieved the rank of lieutenant commander. At the end of the war, because he was on the losing side, they put him in a concentration camp in North Vietnam. The family did not hear from him for months, so they all just assumed that he died. But my father did not die. He survived the concentration camps, and he had come home to me. Shortly after coming home, my father took me out of school and moved the entire family to Saigon to live with his mom and his brothers. There he taught me math and English, the little that he knew, tried to live a normal life, but it proved to be difficult. Randomly, the police would come by to interrogate him. I did not know this at the time because I was always sent away every time they showed up. But apparently they would ask him how he spends his days. And when he couldn't come up with all the answers, they would threaten him with imprisonment. This kind of mental torture worked very well because my father began to have severe nightmares about prison that only got worse with time. And it got so bad that after only a few months of being home, he decided that we must leave Vietnam. But how? This is a communist country, you can't just leave. If you want to get out, you have to escape. The only way we knew was to get on a boat and run for the ocean. But in 1982, one seat on such a boat could cost as much as $10,000. This is money that we just didn't have, especially when you think about a family of five. But I knew my dad would find a way. One day, I was visiting with my grandmother in the country. My parents showed up unexpectedly late one day. I knew something was going on, so I asked them. And they took me aside and said the next day they would take me back to Saigon and we would be escaping the day after that. I asked them, is the whole family coming? And that's when my mom started to cry. She said that in exchange for my dad's skills as a captain of the boat, he was allowed to bring two people with him, but only two, regardless of the size, age, or weight of the passenger. And my two brothers would have to be left behind to be cared for by my grandmother. We would send for them at a later time. She also said that I couldn't discuss this with my middle brother at all. He was 7 and a half at the time, and he could not be trusted with the information. If information got out and my dad was captured, he would be imprisoned, and this time, likelihood is that they would execute him. So we couldn't tell them. So the next day, the whole family was waiting at the roadside, waiting for a bus to take us back to Saigon. There we were when the bus pulled up. Not a bus that you would recognize here in America. It's actually a broken down transport truck from the 60s that someone had fixed up and put passenger benches in the back. My dad told me to get on first, and I did. Sat down on the bench and watched as my parents said goodbye to my brothers. My mom was holding on to my baby brother, already crying. not wanting to let go. But with a little coaxing from my dad, she was able to hand over my baby brother to my aunt, who would be taking care of him. As she did so, she began to wail in agony. She slowly got on the bus and continued to cry and cry as if someone had died. Tears are streaming down her eyes, wetting her shirt. And as the bus pulled away, my brother realized at that point that he was being left behind, and he began to cry, which made my mom's cries get even louder. And I continued to wave to my family as the bus pulled away and they disappeared from view. We got into Saigon late that night, stayed up most of the night talking with my uncles about the trip. We then woke up before dawn and headed toward the bus station. My dad had pre-warned me that we were going to make a lot of exchanges in transportation in order to avoid detection. It was a long day. So we first took a bus out to a town called Vinh Long. And Vinh Long is on the Mekong River Delta. This is where I was born, because that was where my dad was stationed when he was in the Navy. Once we got there, we took a taxi that took us down to the river. And at the river, we took a riverboat taxi that took us out to a transport boat. I remember this transport boat looks like this big brown blob with not many windows, but a huge passenger compartment, kind of reminded me of a semi on water. Once we were inside, I saw all the other passengers, and my dad spoke up. He said, that night we were going to transfer over to the escape boat, and all the people on this boat were going to be escaping with us as well. So I looked around, mostly adults. There were only a few children, all waiting patiently for instructions. We waited for what seemed to be a very long time before a man came up to my dad and said it was time to go. He kissed me. He said he'll see me over at the escape boat because he needed to help transfer people and supplies over. And with that, he was gone. My mom and I waited for our turn, and when it was time, we walked over to the window. My mom handed me to a man standing on a ladder. He carried me down the ladder, and at the bottom of the ladder, he gave me back to my dad. I looked outside, and I could barely make out my dad because it was pitch black except for the light on the moon and the shimmering light off the water. My mom took me into the belly of the boat where we were to stay for the remainder of the night. We waited for the rest of the passengers to show up. And when everyone found their seats in the belly of the boat, the hatch closed, and there we were in complete darkness, waiting to go. And with a sudden roar, the engine started up, and we started moving through the water. We moved faster and faster, and all of a sudden, I hear gunfire. I'd never heard gunfire before, but from movies, I knew what that sound was like, and I got so scared. All day long, my dad had been protecting me from the dangers of the trip by building up this sense of excitement, but now he's not there, and I'm in the dark, and there's a gunfire. I began to cry, and people were crying around me, but my mom stayed strong. She just held me tighter and said, "Don't worry, your dad will get us through this." And with those words, the gunfire stopped. I soon fell asleep to the sounds of the engines moving through the water. I woke a few hours later to the sound of people vomiting around me. The smell and the sounds made me sick as well. A few minutes after that, the hatch opened and it was daylight already. It was raining outside. It was my father. He opened up the hatch and walked down the ladder, and he stood there and made an announcement to the whole boat. He said, "You're all sick because we've made it out to the ocean." And with that, the whole boat erupted in cheers and laughter and applause. "We've escaped from Vietnam. We've made it out." But as we found out, over the next couple of days, once we got above deck, we realized that our dangers were not over yet. Black and blue ocean as far as the eye could see. The weather was tossing our boat around. We were still concerned about being recaptured. We were concerned about the Thai pirates that frequented the South China Sea. But on the third day, our deliverance came. It's a gorgeous day. I can almost feel the warmth of the Indonesian sun on my skin. There was not a cloud in the sky, and the oceans were so calm you felt like you were going through a swimming pool. My dad deliberately headed towards a cluster of islands that separated into two island chains. He went right in between, and when he turned the corner of this one island, a refugee camp came into view. Our freedom had been won. Our lives were saved, and my life was saved by my father. We waited in Indonesia for a year before we were accepted to America as political asylum refugees. Initially, life in America was tough. At one point, we had to live out of a fixed-up garage and go on welfare. But even then, we felt like we had a life of plenty when compared to the family we left behind. It took us 10 years before we were able to unite with my brothers. But we're all together now. My parents live in a home of their own. My middle brother is an accountant. My baby brother graduated from UC Berkeley and is now in sales. I graduated from UCLA for undergrad. I attended medical school in Missouri and did residency in Chicago. I'm now a practicing emergency medicine physician in Southern California. I'm married to a beautiful woman who gave me two wonderful boys, and life is good. So, deliverance comes to all of us in many different ways. For some, it's through divine intervention. For myself, my family, it was through the perseverance of my father. He didn't give up in the war. He didn't surrender when he was in the concentration camps. He never gave up in bringing me to freedom. As I was growing up, he always told me the greatest gift you can ever give me is to be greater than me. And even now, as an adult, as a doctor, as a son who's doing everything I can to help out my parents, I don't think I can ever repay the gift that my father has given me. That was hard. But the future is bright for my family and myself now. But no matter what the future brings, I know through the lessons of my father and the legacy of my family to never, ever give up. Thank you.
That was Fa Lei. Fa is an emergency room physician from Southern California. He called our pitch line to tell us his story. Now, the pitch line lets you leave a two-minute version of a story you want us to hear on our website or phone line. Quite a few people have asked me, are we really listening to all the pitches that come in? And the answer is yes. And it's not just anyone listening. It's the Moth's curatorial producer, Meg Bowles. Meg is a director on the Moth's main stage and also helps cast all of our shows across the country. She knows a great story when she hears one. I recently sat down with Meg to talk about what makes a great pitch.
I think a great pitch is one that's a perfectly condensed version of a larger story. It has a real clear beginning, middle, and end, and all the elements that make a really good story are in there. The pitches kind of fall into two categories. We have one kind that's like an experience type story, like surviving an avalanche or being initiated into a cult, playing with Charles Mingus in a jazz club, helping to evacuate people during Katrina, things that most people will never get to experience firsthand. And then there are the stories that we can all relate to, the stories of loss and of love and surviving our parents or surviving parenthood and the moment someone made a connection or a breakthrough about themselves. I'm always really amazed by the stories that people call and share. And a lot of times it's the biggest moments in their lives. It's the stories that change them forever. And they're incredibly powerful and really humbling to listen to.
You directed Fa Lei in the story that he called into the hotline. So tell me about how you first heard that pitch.
Well, I was really excited when I first heard Fa's story because I had heard about people fleeing Vietnam on boats. But I had never heard a story from the perspective of a child who was on one of those boats and how that affected him.
Here's a part of Fa's original pitch.
My story is about my life. I am an emergency physician practicing emergency in Southern California. But my story begins in Vietnam, where I was born during the Vietnam War. My father was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, and after the war, he was incarcerated in a work camp thousands of miles from his home because he was on the losing side of the war. After almost dying in prison, He was released, and we escaped on a boat from Vietnam to Indonesia. From there, we were sent to America to settle.
So tell us how you went from taking a story that was a 2-minute pitch and turning it into a 12-minute moth story.
Well, with Fa, it was easy. In the first 10 minutes, he told me about how he grew up. Like, his first memories of in childhood were of him asking his mother where was his father, and she would tell him that he died in the war. And so he had no idea that his father was even alive. And
neither of them did, right?
Yeah, no. Nobody knew. They all thought that he had died. But I think, you know, when you hear all of these details unfold and you hear that, you know, all these different things happened to him in the course of the story, you know, that there's more there. There's a main stage story there, no doubt.
Okay, so now on the opposite end of the spectrum, what makes a bad pitch? What should people calling never, ever do?
Okay, well, I think my biggest piece of advice is don't tell me about the time your sister went to Mozambique if you weren't with her. This has to be your story. You have to know all the details, and you have to feel all the emotions that went along with that experience. So, and my pet peeve, the cliffhanger. I've had many a cliffhanger, and I have called many a cliffhanger back, only to be very disappointed that there's no payoff. You know, somebody will tell you the story on the pitch line where I went into a store and everybody seemed really nervous, and I wasn't quite sure what was going on, and I'm standing in line, and then somebody sticks something in my back. And that was the moment my life changed. And if you want to know more, call me back. And then I call them back and they're like, oh yeah, no, somebody just tapped me on the shoulder. So when I hear a cliffhanger, it is to me a sign that it most likely isn't a good story and that you're using the cliffhanger as a way to get noticed. And I promise if it's a compelling story, you will be noticed and we will call you. So just tell us the story.
To hear more of my interview with Meg, you can go to our website, themoth.org. You can also pitch us your own story or listen to pitches other people have left. When we come back, the Reverend Wayne Reese tells us about an Easter morning culture clash in Texas in the 1960s.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Catherine Burns, Artistic Director of the Moth. Our last story is from the Reverend Wayne Reese. He told it on a night we called OMG, Stories of the Sacred. Here's Reverend Reese live at the Moth.
Travel with me, if you will, to a space called the Panhandle in North Texas. Travel with me, if you will, to a time in the year 1960, 50 years ago, specifically the Saturday before Easter. I was in my last year in seminary at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, but I was also pastoring four churches that I had just gone to two months before, in January. And on that Saturday, I was agonizing to finish my sermon that I had worked on all week long, trying to get it down to the perfection that that Christian preachers try to do on Easter. I had put in some of my own experiences and my reflections. I had also dropped in some wonderful quotations from the theologians of the day. And I was ready to preach that day, but I had to wait another day. Now, that Saturday in the evening, some of the 14 of the kids from the four churches that I was serving, Sadler, Gordonsville, Gunter, and Tioga, they came over to a special time that would prepare them for Easter. At 9 o'clock, they all left, and one guy was left, His friend had left him behind and had forgotten him. And Brian asked me if I could take him home to Tioga. And I said, sure. And I told my wife that where I was going and what I was doing. And so Brian and I jumped into my station wagon and we headed off. But for me, this was virgin territory, uncharted. I had driven these roads in the last 2 months during the day on the major thoroughfares, but I had not traveled those country roads in the dark. I got Brian to his home, dropped him, and headed back. It's about 10 o'clock at night, and I was needing to get home and get to bed so I could be prepared for the four messages the next morning. And then it happened. I had forgotten to fill up my gas tank that day. My car started to sputter and spit, and then it died. What do I do? I'm out here in the middle of nowhere. I can't see anything. And so I wondered, where do I go? Who can I find? There was no house around. There were no gas stations around. And so I apprehensively, but knowingly, got out of my car, locked it up, and started going someplace, not knowing where I was going or when I was going to get there and what I would find when I got there. So I'd walked almost 2 hours, or at least it seemed 2 hours, but actually I found out when I got there to the place, I'd only been gone 35 minutes. But I saw in the distance a gleaming light, and like a moth being drawn to the flame, I went to that glow, and as I neared it, I heard twanging, blaring music, and I found myself at a country roadhouse, surrounded by pickup trucks and motorcycles. Now, I had never been in one of these, and I didn't know what to expect. But I knew that I had to have somebody try to help me, and I wondered if I would find anybody like that here. So I apprehensively went into the roadhouse, and over on the side, there was a little room, and there were three guys in there playing pool. And so I thought, well, maybe they could help me, or at least they could tell someone who could help me. So I went in there, and just as I walked in, one guy came up to me, and he said, hey, I'm Eric, and do you want to play pool? I thought maybe they thought I could be hustled because I had, well, I looked like I had money. But anyhow, I said, well, I used to play pool when I was in high school. And then I thought to myself, and I had done pretty well, but I hadn't played for 6 years. He said, well, would you break on a game of stripes and solids? And I said, sure. So I racked them up, went to get the cue stick, chalked it up, put talc on my hands, and stroked and cracked the rack, meaning they broke. One ball went in. I did it again. Two balls had gone in. Three balls went in, and by now I realized that I had amazingly gotten back my youthful talent of pool. Well, to make a long story short, I put in four more balls. There was only one ball left, the eight ball. This is the pièce de résistance in eight ball. I called it for the left corner pocket. I stroked, hit, and it went in. And immediately, Eric said, uh-oh, we've got a pool shark in our midst. He was kinder than another guy. He said, okay, are you a pool hustler in the neighborhood? Well, I thought to myself, what do I say? And Eric said, okay, come and sit down. We sat down, and a couple of other guys joined us at the table, and he said, I want you to tell us why you are in our neighborhood. Oh, man, what did I say to these guys? I said, okay, I'm the new preacher at the Tioga Methodist Church. I'm on my way back to Sadler, which was about 30 miles away. I ran out of gas. I've got to get home because I'm preaching at four churches in the morning, and because it's Easter. Roy said, "What's Easter?" Two of the guys chided Roy because of what he had said, but he said, "Honestly, I've never been to church before, and I want to know the story about Easter." So I thought to myself, what do I tell Roy? Do I give him the sermon that I had prepared and that was filled with illustrations from Paul Tillich's The New Being? Or do I try to find new ways to tell the story, the old, old story, to the new ears of Roy? So I thought for a moment, and then I swallowed and started in. Now, there was this guy named Jesus, and he gathered around him 12 guys of his friends, and they were his gang, and they roamed the countryside together, and they talked about peace and justice and love and God, and they did great things. But the authorities wanted to get him, and so they tried to find ways of either capturing him or killing him. Well, I told a little bit more of the story until I came down to the end, and I said, one night, one of the gang ratted on him to the authorities. And so they caught Jesus, and the next day they hanged him on a tree, and they killed him. 2 days later, they went. Some of the gang went to try to find him in the tomb where they had laid him, and he wasn't there. And they searched around and asked around, and finally someone said, God has raised Jesus from the dead and has given him new life. Now, Roy, that's the story of Jesus, and that's the story of Easter. And Roy blurted out, man, that's an awesome story. And I said, you know, I believe in an awesome God. After a brief period of silence, Eric seemed to be the leader, and he got up and he said, let's go get the shark some gas. Hey, I had a new name, the shark. And I had a bunch of new guys as my friends. Well, anyhow, we went outside, and they siphoned some gas from someplace. I don't know where. They put it in a can. Eric gave me the can and said, hey, sit on the back with me. And so I got on the motorcycle with him, and this was another new first. I'd never been on a motorcycle before. So we traveled 3 miles down the dusty road. I got off, poured the gas in the can, gave the can back to Eric, and they took off without saying a word. And I was sorry to see my new friends go. Well, I finally got home about 12:30, and my wife was frantic because she didn't know what had happened to me. You see, that was BC, before cell phones. And she said, why don't you come to bed? And I said, I can't come to bed. I had a great experience tonight. I got stranded. I got friends. I played pool. I told the story of Easter to new people. I have got to rewrite my sermon because the intellectual sermon that I have prepared for my people tomorrow is not their story. And so she went up to bed, and I hurriedly wrote down the new message that had come to me as I was driving back on that awesome travel from the roadhouse. I went to bed. I felt great and spent and excited. This was going to be a chance to tell the story of the faith that had meant so much to me and had called me into ministry. So I woke up the next morning. I had headed off to the first three churches on the circuit. And after each church, I felt more confident and more expectant. And I realized that if at all possible, I would never preach sermons the old way. So I got to Tioga at 1 o'clock. And I walked in, and there the people were, 80 wonderful people dressed in their finery. As we were beginning to sing the first hymn, what did I hear outside but a roar of motorcycles coming up? And in walked seven guys dressed in their black leather jackets and their black leather pants, their uniform that they had on last night. And the usher looked at me and wondered what he was supposed to say. And on his own, he said, "Could I help you?" And Eric, in his great basso voice, said, "Hey, we're here to hear the shark tell the story of Easter." Again.
That was Wayne Reese. He's been a United Methodist pastor for more than 5 decades and has served congregations in Texas, Indiana, Michigan, and the UK. He lives in Nashville, Tennessee with his wife and has 4 daughters, 14 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Full disclosure, I first heard the story at dinner back in 2003 because Wayne's my uncle. We didn't want to be accused of favoritism, which is probably why we waited nearly 10 years to have him tell it at the Moth. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time. And that's the story from the Moth.
Your host this hour was the Moth's artistic director, Catherine Burns. Catherine also directed the stories in the show, along with Meg Bowles. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Jennifer Hickson. Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Echter. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift, other music in this hour from Tin Hat and Smokin' Joe Kubek. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.